Hello, this is Robin Ince. Welcome to Robin and Josie's.
I used to know Christmas.
Oh, we haven't. That was a terrible start, wasn't it? You started off well.
Hello, this is Robin Ince. Welcome to Robin and Josie's Utter Shambles. Today we've got five people in the studio, which is the most we've ever had in situ.
Hello, I'm Josie Long, and
do me. Do you like how I am?
I'm Josie Long, and I've got too many grapes in my mouth. Oh, hang on a minute. I wasn't expecting it to start now. You say something, Izzy.
Hello, my name's Danielle Ward. I've got a bloodshot eye.
Now, Izzy City, we should, before we introduce everyone, we should say you were cut off there with an anecdote about Christopher Casanova.
I used to know Christopher Casanova. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. But
isn't he?
Yeah, we were. No.
So have you broken that to me a bit harshly? When did he die?
About the year or year and a half ago, I think. But we went for a drink in Kennington because some friends of mine know him, and it was a really great night. And then at the end, we all had Horlicks and Kahlua. I can't remember if he was there then, but I had a massive phase of drinking Horlicks and Kahlua whenever I was drunk. It's amazing.
Where do you go? What pubs do you go to that have? Because sometimes it's hard to get a coffee. I wouldn't have expected Horlicks to be, you know, along the optics.
It was at our house.
Oh, okay.
It would be amazing if pubs served Horlicks, though.
Mm. You just have people just nodding off in the corner.
Advocaat's a bit like Horlicks, I suppose, or same consistency.
Have you ever warmed up Advocaat?
No, doesn't it split like a hollandaise sauce?
That's Danielle Ward joining us.
Hello.
And welcome to our In Memory of Christopher Casanova and Horlicks special. He was Christopher Casanova, one of the great kind of late 70s, early 80s, always played earls and lords and occasionally scurrilous, perhaps almost thieves. I would say it was Casanova, Havers, McCorkindale. There's a little group, isn't there, really?
Yeah.
Also, sadly, Simon
McCormick.
And Richard Herring is our third guest. But we're not here to talk about Horlicks, annoyingly, or the career of Christopher Casanova, Simon McCorkindale, or Nigel Havers. This is our Edinburgh special.
I don't like that we've got themes now.
Do you know what? You know you don't like there being a theme?
Yeah.
Well, we know we had that one the other day which had a theme.
Yeah.
Well, you managed to show your derision for the theme by never really talking about it. We didn't have a theme in the end.
What was the theme?
Well, it was kind of Rufus Hound actor. We were looking at the mind of Rufus Hound actor versus the mind of Rufus Hound comedian. And what clashes the word within that? And also, of course, Rufus Hound panelist, game show panelist.
Was Rufus Hound present?
It wasn't just like, today we examine.
I bet he had a lot to say about it.
Yeah, no, he's
the best person to ask about.
I was going to cry on stage.
You're going to cry on stage?
No, I saw Rufus Hound cry on stage.
Oh, yeah. What happened?
Him and his wife were going through a rough patch.
Right, so far we found out Rufus Hound...
That's really sad.
Are you sure it was his wife? Hang on, how long ago was this?
Oh, it might have been his girlfriend.
How long ago was this?
About 7 years ago.
Yeah, that was before he's very happily married with his wife. And So, Christopher Casanova's dead. Rufus Hound wasn't happy 7 years ago. And Richard, your career's, of course, had a few ups and downs as well, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, we'll start off because Edinburgh Fringe Festival, when this goes out, it's all starting. And you, I think, I would imagine around this table, is this the 24th year you've done Edinburgh Fringe?
It's my 25th anniversary. It's actually my 21st separate Fringe I've done. I missed three quite early on and then I've missed two since 1992.
And what was it, when you first went, so you went up in the late 80s, part of the Oxford Review, with, it was you, Al Murray, Stuart Lee, Ben Moore.
There was Emma Kennedy, Armando Iannucci was the year before-ish, David Schneider, all sorts of people,
And when you went up there, what were your expectations? Because now, of course, people do realise when they go up there that it's a trade fair, they're going to hopefully get a good review from like 3 weeks or something like that. And then when they bring that back down to London, people will, you know, the doors will open.
Yeah, there was a lot less competition then, but it was just an interesting point when we went up as students because alternative comedy had basically taken over the Fringe. So we came up as students doing the Oxford Review and were basically just pilloried and attacked and not physically.
Oh, really?
Not physically, yeah. Well, actually, Keith Allen came into the first night, the press night, and moved some crash mats, heckled the first sketch, walked out and punched the theatre manager, then reviewed the show going, the Oxford Review, as you'd expect, shit, and on to the next thing. So there was this very, and we got booked in to do The Gilded Balloon, and late in life, and then just it seemed, I think, like, it probably hadn't been set up, but it seemed like every stand-up comedian in the in town had come just to heckle us. So we kind of went on stage and were just barraged by all. I was looking to the audience and seeing all these people that I respected and thought, oh, this is, you know, I want to do this as my job, and all these people hate me for no reason. So it was like a really odd point to go up. So I don't think we went up with any expectations of anything happening. We just kind of hoped to get out alive. Although I think when you're young, you sort of think, oh, maybe someone will see me and I'll get my own show on ITV and be al fresco.
Al fresco, for some of our, was Robbie Coltrane, Emma Thompson, Fry, Laurie, and who was Ben Elton as well. So there we go. Just because some of the people, a lot of people listening to this weren't alive.
No, they weren't.
Including people around this table possibly weren't alive when al fresco
Well, you know,
first
a lot of people
out.
Weren't alive. Most of the people who will be performing at Edinburgh weren't alive when I first performed in Edinburgh, which is a terrifying, horrible thought. So yeah, it was actually, I mean, it was just a barrel. The first year was a little bit different. 87, because it was me and Stu and a few other people, Emma Kennedy, in a sort of little lunchtime review, and it didn't get much, you know, no one came to see it basically, so we weren't expecting much of that. But then the next year I was in the Oxford Review that Stu and me wrote. And so, yeah, you know, we just weren't really given a chance to do any of our stuff.
When you saw Keith Allen punch the manager, did you think that's the kind of punch that would suggest he would be good playing an angry tooth fairy in a mouthwatch advert? Do you think you would have thought at that point he could have been the star of a mouthwatch advert?
I find it hilarious that he's sent his children to private schools because he's such a rebel, isn't he? I was going to...
Well, what are they least expecting me to do?
You know what I did? Last year, I was researching the book that I am still to finish, and I went into the archives of the Oxford Review, and I found loads of scripts that you and Stuart wrote when you were like 19, 20, and it's all in Stuart's handwriting. And they were good sketches as well.
It was handwritten.
Yeah, and photocopied as well, like half typed, half handwritten.
Yeah, see, my first joke of yours, I remember hearing, but even that was sometimes you used to do a routine in which you confused Salman Rushdie with Willie Rushton.
Yeah, I did.
Which I imagine was...
I did a character. I did a sort of precursor to the pub landlord a little bit, in that he was a sort of like a Somerset old man, sort of slightly xenophobic and confused, and so got everything wrong, you know. So it would all be like, you know, what about that? What about that? Salman Rushdie, what about those Ayatollah Khomeini giving that death threat against Willie Rushton? What's he done? What's he ever done? All that sort of thing. So it was, you know, it was this kind of stupid old man character that I did at college. And then I think I tried to do it in, you know, in the circuit when I first came to London with largely not succeeding. I was very, when I first came to stand up in London, I was really confused. I'd been so into doing sketches, and because of all this experience I had in Edinburgh, I kind of hated all stand ups and kind of felt they hated me. So I felt like it was a battle, and I didn't really want to become a stand up. I wanted to do sketches and prove that actually sketches were the best. It was a battle that I slowly lost against myself and realised I was wrong. But so I kind of was doing, when I came to London, I was sort of doing character stuff, and then got really confused and bogged down in trying to be a version of myself or be myself, and it just didn't really work for a couple of years, really.
See, when you first did it, though, I would have thought, because I went up to Edinburgh not as an act when I was 18, 1987, and it seemed quite a joyous thing, whereas now, by about the second week, you will start to see people, you know, weeping openly in the streets. There is a sense of utter failure and a realisation of your own bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And this kind of, you know, basically it's a hideous painting, isn't it?
Oh,
of,
stop it.
It's a Bosch. It's a Hieronymus Bosch image of a bunch of comedians like small-legged shells being beaten.
Yeah.
No, but it's all not over by the first Tuesday, isn't it? You know he's going to win.
Come on, guys.
I don't think I enjoyed it till about the last five. I've only enjoyed the last 5 years. I've done all those times, and I've just been miserable most of the time. I love it. I love doing. I love the festival, and I love the kind of ability, you know, the thing to go and do the show. But it's sort of so frustrating when people aren't coming, or when you get bad reviews, or, you know, or just you're losing loads of money. And in the last 5 years, I've kind of enough people come that I know I'm going to have a nice time and not lose money. And the reviews don't really matter, and I'm not up for any awards, and so I can just do the shows and really enjoy the shows. And I can't go out and get drunk and, you know, do all the other things I used to go up for. You know, it's almost the reverse. I used to go up because it was my holiday, and I'd get drunk and talk to girls, which I never did for the rest of the year because I never met any, and get overexcited. And now I'm just live very unhealthily and put on 3 stone. Now I go to Edinburgh, go to the gym every day, just do my shows and go to bed.
I do. Going swimming in the sea, getting a bike, or going to the gym every day, seeing all my friends, not reading reviews at all. And it's great.
It's great not
what
reading
about
reviews.
When someone sends you a text going, Sorry about that review.
Oh, well, we'll get on to that's something. But in fact, Danielle, we'll ask you about that now.
I'd love to hear. I would love to see how that sound is expressed in a text.
Yeah, me too.
Probably an emoticon.
Yeah,
for
must be, yeah.
But what I tend to do, like now, I'll just be mean. Like if somebody's like that, I'll be like, well, not mean. I'll just not hide my exasperation. I'll be like, I don't read reviews. It's actually very unhelpful. And if you think about why you said that, it's kind of weird. You shouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
Well, that's
part of the madness that happens. But I mean, Danielle, what was the first year you did the Edinburgh Fringe Festival?
In 2004, I did some open spots, and then 2005, I did a show, full length show with Roisin Conaty.
And we all lived together.
I washed your pants.
Yeah, you did.
In the bath.
Because the washing machine broke.
I remember you were slightly annoyed by Jyoti after a while, weren't you? Because you felt she put no effort into the cleaning. I remember that now.
No.
It's 7 years ago now. Let's not worry about it. So that was your... And what was your... When you went up there, first of all, your expectation as you went... You were playing one of the caves, I think, weren't you?
I was in the caves, yeah. We were in the caves. Well, I don't know. There wasn't really... There wasn't really a lot of expectation because I was doing a two-hander. So you know that you're not eligible for any awards, and the best you can get out of it is maybe some gigs. I think it was when I found the weird thing for me with Edinburgh is I didn't take a stand-up show up, which is where you become famous and you get all the telly work. For like a good 4 years, I just did stupid plays and a weird musical. So I sort of burnt the bridge of being an exciting newcomer by doing really weird stuff. And then by the time I did do a stand-up show, no one was interested.
But what was you were saying that picking up on that thing where... Because I think over the particularly that month of August, there are people who I go, oh, I didn't know you were like that. The fear, the financial fear, and the amount of retweeting of casual compliments. I had to stop following Paul Daniels last year on Twitter because not just everyone. You know, it'll just be you know, Matt Sorbet. Saw Matt Sorbet last night. Enjoyed it. Retweet. I'm Matt Sorbet. I'm Matt Sorbet. I may be Matt Sorbet.
I don't go on Twitter during that.
But not even just Twitter. The whole thing is suddenly people you thought were quite nice
will
come up to you and go, how's it going? And before you've answered, they go, because I just got 4 stars and get loads of people and everything's going really well for me. I've had TV people. They're very, very interesting.
Well,
everything's really, really good.
That's why there's a couple of comics who I've only just started to like personally again, because when they were first up in Edinburgh, they'd come up to me in the street going, I'm not going to do the impression because then you'd know who it was. I've had an amazing time. I've just got 4 stars and I'm writing a sitcom and all these things are happening. I'm like,
let's work that. Who's recently had 4 stars and has written a sitcom?
And you'd recognise them from their accent.
Sing-songy interpretation of the voice. Yeah. So, yeah, but that thing where... So you've got not only... What? Do it again. Just mouth it towards the microphone so the audience at home can... Oh, yeah.
Who?
I still don't know who it is.
Reach it.
Was it me?
So, anyway, so this thing where you were saying, Daniel, though, sorry, I'll let you, but Daniel, so this thing as well where people will come up to you and don't they normally do, it's I suppose kind of the opposite of the humble brag or whatever it is, that thing where someone will go, by the way, I have heard your show is great and I would certainly not listen to what Brian Logan in the Guardian has said.
Yes, and you just think, do you know, because I think especially if you don't court it, like I don't read reviews. I don't go on Twitter for the month of August. I don't go on Facebook because I don't want... Do you know what? If you really hate my show, at least have the decency to send me a letter about it. I'm not interested in anything else.
Like in the olden days.
It's a proper abuse coming through the post.
If you hate my show, don't send me any letters.
You can send me letters.
Send a
letter
to Danielle.
But it's got to be my home address, otherwise it doesn't count. So it's not just a fear of reviews. Like, it's not that kind of, oh my God, I don't want to read something awful about myself. I have got to the stage where I just sort of don't care. Like, you just think...
Well, that's what I realised.
That's fantastic.
Who cares what these people think?
But as well, I realised something, which was, in 2005, I got my first properly bad review in the papers.
Which show is that for?
That was for a two-hander I did with my friend Dan Nightingale.
Oh, yeah, I remember seeing that show.
Great stand-up in Manchester.
Enjoyed that show.
Thank you.
Yeah,
and in it was, I remember it exactly, it was because Stuart Lee had taken me out on tour that year and, like, just changed my life.
In a desperate bid to destroy her, as he often does with younger comics.
Yeah, we had a car crash, he tried to. No. It was from Brian Donaldson, who used to run the list, who really doesn't like me at all, and has basically written 2 reviews in which he's tried to make me stop doing comedy. And one of them was lots of people who should know better have said this is a good comedian. She may actually be the worst comedian in the universe, which is pretty categorical. And then a few years later, he said, everyone is so desperate for there to be a female comedian to rise above the dross. And Josie Long has the world at her feet. But she's not it, and she ruins it, and she pisses it all away, and she's awful, two stars, right? And both of those times, I felt genuinely like he wanted to stop me doing what I wanted to do. Yeah. And at the time, I was like, and especially as well when you get like loads of, after my first Edinburgh show, getting loads of like online abuse and stuff, all those people wanted me to stop, and I was really scared that that would damage my career and my ambitions. I was like, oh, great, now all the people who I want to work with will stop working with me and all the TV people won't want me and blah, blah, blah.
Government have brought in a bill which is suggesting Josie Long should be banned generally. Exactly. Made to live on Sark.
Exactly, which I would actually like, so I like the...
you like tractors, but you hate cars.
Exactly. So yeah.
I've been to Sark.
Have you? Mm-hmm.
True about the tractor-car thing, isn't it?
Yeah, very true. But
anyhow, then I realised this year, pardon me, that pretty much all the things that I've not achieved have been through my own ineptitude, bad luck, or just, you know, clash of personalities or whatever, or because I'm a woman, you know, that kind of shit. And none of them had, there's no effect on any of, like, those reviews had no effect. I just kept going.
Yeah, it's.
And it was like, oh, yeah, it doesn't matter. Like, it
well,
really
no one else notices
effect.
Them. I think I do read them because I sometimes think occasionally someone will say something that's worth it. And I think, like, a lot of people say the same thing. But it's just like, but you kind of get a review from your audience, right? So you know night after night, if you do the same show, you know the bit that works and the doesn't work, and then you work on the bit that doesn't work. So your audience is your reviewer.
Yes, it has to be like that. It's a kind of communal process.
And it's over a period of time. Sense. You know, you could do a show five times and the joke doesn't get a laugh, you might tweak it, then it might work, or it might just suddenly start working. You know, you need to do 10 or 15 shows and then you've got an idea, but you will know, you'll get, as you're doing Edinburgh, you'll know, I've got to really work on this bit of the show because there's something... The pace drops here or whatever. I just need a new joke in here or whatever, and that's your critic. But there are some critics, I think, will sometimes say something perceptive that might help you, but not. I guess it's not worth it for the.
My dad's got me on Google Alert.
Oh no!
So he'll know when I don't. No. So he'll know if they go. Well, this is one of the Bryans in Scotland didn't like you very much. That sounds awful.
That happened to me. When I did the Comedy Zone in 2005, and I didn't understand that at fringe.com, I didn't really, not very good with the internet anyway, I didn't understand there was a place where people could leave comments. And my mate from home, Caroline Ramifon, was like, I'm so worried about you, and I just want you to know that everyone in Matlock thinks you're really good. And when you come back here, I was like, what? And she was like, oh, I've just been looking at edfringe.com. And I was like, oh no. And then I looked at it, it was just like really horrible comments. And I was like, oh, I know you think you're helping, but you know, there was a point where they're going to send food parcels and stuff.
Especially one of the comments that went, I imagine everyone in Matlock hates her. They get in contact. We all... So what was it? Was that your first Fringe, Izzy?
No, that... yes, I suppose it was. I did a show called Frog in Love in 2000.
What, based on the wonderful Frog in Love books?
Yes.
Oh, you're the best person I've ever met. Max, that's the Frog in Love alert there.
Gone off.
Or alternatively, not turn the phone off.
Win a prize.
That's lovely.
It's a work in here.
Frog in Love, you'd like Frog in Love. Frog doesn't feel well and he doesn't know why. He's got a rumbly tummy. He's not feeling very well. It turns out Frog's in love.
Yeah.
So you did Frog in Love.
Yes. I did Frog in Love. I was the rat who he fell in love with.
Oh, that's never going to work.
No, I know. I think it's a sort of metaphor for like gay relationships or something. Or, you know, like everyone
gay
can...
people are rats, right? That's what you're saying.
No!
Yeah.
Herring offends gays and women.
I did that in 2003. or 2004. And I did a few stand-up spots then because I'd just started stand-up. But the first run that I did of a comedy show as opposed to a kids show was in 2005 when I did the Comedy Zone with Russell Kane, Mark Olver and Matt Green.
Aww. So that, I mean, that, again, I think that old men like Richard and me would have approached the Fringe in a different way. Like when I first saw it, I was a teenager. The first thing I did was a play called Shadow Walker, which ended with...
Really?
Yeah.
How old were you?
I was 19 with legs to die for. and I went up just being excited by the Fringe. But by the time you were going up, and also you were, that was a big agent who were running the show, and you feel under a lot of pressure. So did you go up thinking, oh, this will be fun? Or did you go up going, right, what's going to happen? Will this affect my career? Or...
No, I felt that I should do the Zone. I felt like it was a kind of rite of passage and I admired people who'd done it before. And I knew I wasn't ready to do an hour. And I thought I'll probably lose less money if I do the zone than I would if I did like a two-hander. And it was quite a baptism of fire, really. And afterwards, it made me realise that I didn't really want to do weekend clubs and that I wanted to get... Because I just don't really go well in those environments. I don't feel that it helps me to be in them. So, and then that made me work towards doing more gigs that I liked doing for probably less money, which is the situation that I'm in now, but I'm a lot happier.
What about when you're, I mean, you're doing a group show, you've got four comedians. Now, we were talking about the fact that even when you're doing solo shows, you're still going to bump into other comedians who are then going to say something which is ultimately meant to be facetious, but, you know, couched in the idea that it's said out of love. Now, you've actually got three people backstage with you as well. Was that difficult? Did you feel there was a real competition?
A bit, but this sort of pattern set itself up whereby I would normally die.
It's like me when I was in a package show.
Yeah,
I just died every single
day. Yeah, I did absolutely last time. Yeah.
So what do you
now,
sort of accept?
Now I just die on my own for longer, which is far more kind of... Nah.
It's more fulfilling in a way.
More luxurious, like a spa treatment.
You'd think that I would go on in the middle, which is traditionally the cushy spot, isn't it? But for some reason it worked better if I opened, then I would sort of die a bit less than I would in the middle. Russell always closed, Olver always compared, and Matt Green went in the middle. But I remember there's all this writing on the wall of the cabaret bar that said stuff like, you can do it, guys, come on. And I remember it was all, every night it was like a battle. I did feel sort of genuinely scared. But I used to go on to the Eels, and I always knew if I was going to have a good gig, because if the audience sang along, because there was a stag party once in the front row, and they sang along to the song as I walked on, and I thought, oh, you're going to be all right. And then it was actually quite fun, but...
Which one was it? Novocaine for the Soul? Or
No, it was Do You Know What It's Like to Fall on the Floor? Cry Your Guts Out. I also got paid to get off in the zone. I got paid £20 to get off because I was dying so hard.
I remember seeing you. I mean,
Edinburgh, that's a lot of. So that's the weird thing as well, though. Backstage in the room that you're in when you're doing the Comedy Zone are all these posters that go back about 20 years. And I imagine part of the horror is you see these people and go, oh no, look at that old, decrepit, hideous face now. Is this what comedy, apart from Chris Addison's poster, in which he looks slightly older at 23 than he does now? But that sense, I suppose, of pressure when you're actually up there going, all these people have done this thing, I've got to.
Yes.
How do you keep... Because I found that the hardest thing, which is when you're having a tough Edinburgh life. I've had the number of disasters. Howard Reed broke my arm, which meant that I couldn't actually move it unless I took loads of drugs, but I had to save them all before I went... prescription drugs before I went on stage. But then if I took them all before I went on stage, immediately in one fell swoop, that made me mentally, after the 20 minutes I'd done, quite ill, and I'd sometimes almost burst into tears on stage if I did a later gig. I didn't actually burst into tears, but it was that thing where you go, I think taking all the painkillers in one fell swoop really affects you. And then there was the year where my house flooded with sewage and I lost everything I owned and I was doing Radio 2 show that I hate. All of these things. And there is a point where you go, time, August, is this one reason I wish I was doing a full run in Edinburgh is at least it would mean I'd have a really long August. Because I find there's a sense of time.
Slow
you
down
go
time
up,
before death.
You cross Berwick-upon-Tweed and you get to Edinburgh and then it's the third day and you go, well, I've been here about 4 months, haven't I? How can it only be the third day? I mean, what is the tenacity? Or, Josie, you know, of just keeping going when you constant pressure and...
And I didn't mean to... But I had that 2008, it was my third solo show, and the first two had gone really well comparatively. Like, the second one, I got loads of bad reviews, but it didn't seem to matter. Like, that sounds like I only got bad reviews, I got good ones as well.
Can I just say, by the way, later on, we are going to do another bit of this show to make sure it doesn't sound like we're all rubbish. Because four of you are actually going to Edinburgh. No, you're not, are you, Izzy?
I'm not.
You're going, aren't you, Daniel?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is, we are now, just so you know, this is just the bad experience of Edinburgh. Everyone around this table has also received glowing reviews and is certainly considered by their peers to be often the highlight of their week.
And also, I think that gay people are great, and the fact that Frog in Love was a metaphor for gay relationships, I just meant it was accepting that people should be able to fall in love with anyone they want.
So sorry, Josie, about tenacity.
It wasn't that bad a year in retrospect, I suppose, but for some reason, for me, it felt so difficult. Like, the shows really were, everyone was into it, or no one was into it, really, or it seemed that way. And I had it by about the 10th that I was so exhausted, and I was in bed in my flat, just on the phone to my boyfriend at the time, being like, I can't do it, like an hour before the show, and him being like, well, just come home, you know, it doesn't matter, does it? And I was like, of course it matters, I can't come home. And then you just don't.
Do you know what,
you
three
Les Dennis's, must the show go on?
No one cares, you can go, like, that's the other thing, you, like, no one outside of Edinburgh cares at all about the festival.
I know, but it matters a lot to me.
I think psychologically, I think you'd go home and it would be like, skiving work where for the first hour you'd be like, oh, I could do whatever I want. I'm going to go to the cinema in the day. And then you sort of go, actually, everyone else is up there. I find it hard 1 year because I was living with actors. I wasn't living with comics. And that made me realise I should never, ever do that again because they were sort of like warming up and stuff. And I was like, what are you doing? Like, it was very weird. You have to be, I think you have to be in a bubble with other comics or on your own or with a loved one or whatever. But I think if you're around like people who aren't comedians, you sort of do feel
they don't understand.
No, it's just a different process for them. I think when you even when we did Take Bright Tales, which is a show that Danielle wrote that I did in 2006, I had a very different experience from doing a solo show. I didn't feel quite as much pressure at all, especially as I wasn't losing money.
Yeah,
but you just have to keep working on it as well. Like you never see it as a final product, and you just have to try your hardest to take every day as a new opportunity for it to be fun. But also, like, I don't think of it in a cynical way. I don't think of it in terms of what can I get out of it or how much money will I earn or lose. I just honestly go there because it's the only time of the year where I get to hang out with all my friends, be in one place the whole time, really feel like, you know, this is pathetic, but when I was a little kid, I looked at who was winning the Perrier Award and I thought it was really special and important, you know? Like, now I go there and every year it gets more and more like, we're actually the comedians. Like, we're the comedians and we're the people that people are going, oh, well, did you see them walk across the road? I wonder what they were doing. And you are that, you know?
She walks across the road just like you'd imagine Josie Long walks across the road with, like, kind of political, like, endeavour as well in the walk. It's in the shoes.
But I love it. And also, I genuinely adore seeing what my peers are doing because you get to properly inhabit their world. It's exciting and it makes you up your game. And it's nice. It's the only time when I feel like I'm really part of something structured, and the rest of the time, you know, I don't feel I could just fall off the edge of the world, you know. Whereas with Edinburgh, I feel like, no, look.
You're alive for the first time?
Oh, yeah. I'm really alive.
It's a week
I'm breathing
too long,
the air.
You're right. It does feel the last week.
Monday.
The last week is now, like, people aren't there anymore. You know, they used to end on a high, and now the high is the middle week and end, and then you've got a week to go. I remember when Katie, my now, who's my wife, which was there for a couple of weeks and then went away for the last week, and I was carrying on doing the show. And it just felt like there was 9 shows to go for about 6 days. You know, I'd come in every day and go, it can't still be 9 shows to go. It was like almost like it just felt like the days weren't passing by the end at all.
There is a bit. How many has anyone here? Because I had a couple of experiences where I just got to the point of going, I think I'm just going to walk down to the station, just go Edinburgh Waverley, and just get on the train and just go. Because we were just talking about that. Because in Les Dennis's book, Must the Show Go On, recommended by Mark Lawson, which I actually read recently in a caravan, which is a very good place to read it. Yeah. And it is a really interesting book because his book is all about the fact that he looks back now and goes, why did I think I had to go on stage? It's like things like when his dad died, when Dustin G, his comedy partner, died. He's thinking, why am I doing Panto the day after the guy I was doing Panto with has died? Why am I doing that? And that thing that you can escape is the one side, I think, is, you can escape. If you escape once, doesn't that mean every time you're at the side? Because how many people here are at the side of the stage going, I'm going on in a minute? At that point, you go, even if you've been waiting the whole day, for the last half hour, you go, oh, I think I still need a wee, I feel sick. Oh, this doesn't look like my crowd at all. These are entirely the wrong people. It's going to be a disaster.
Do you know, I had an experience recently. I was booked to do a preview, and it was quite far out of London, so it took me 2 hours to get there, and it was during the Euros, and they'd left the football on in the room.
Oh, for
So they.
But it wasn't even England.
It wasn't even England. No, the sound of it is that it was whatever match was after the first England match, and they turned the sound down. But it was in a room, so the football was still on in this big bar. So there was like the bit where the stage was, and then a bar in the middle, and then another bit at the back. So it wasn't as if the TV was behind me, but the TV was on in the room, and there were only about 8 people there. And I said to the promoter, "I'll go on if it wasn't even meant to be. That it was meant to be downstairs, but they moved the space." And I said, "I'll go on if they turn the TV off, but I'm not going on if it's kept on." And they went, "Oh, well, if you want to." And I said, "Look, you know, if you really want me to go on, I will. But I'm telling you, as a performer, I'd really rather not. I don't think this is, you know, I didn't make huge demands. I just said I'd rather TV was turned off." And they went, no, it's fine. If you don't want to go on, you don't go on. And I got abuse on Twitter from people who were in the audience going, "I can't believe you didn't do the gig." And I was like, well, they'd kept the telly on.
Was that sound on as well?
Yeah, the sound was on as well.
Oh,
and you think, actually, I'm really glad I didn't do it.
You wouldn't do that in your living room.
But also, people are going to be reacting to the game once you begin, woo!
Exactly.
In the middle of your jokes.
Exactly.
Yeah, you have to build it in.
And also with a preview.
I didn't realize it was that good.
You know, and this is like early June, so you know that people aren't, you know, the show's not going to be as focused as it should be. An hour's a long time to do with an audience who are doing other things that you can kind of get away with 20 minutes.
I think any audience that are doing other things, meetings are probably not really even technically an audience.
Well, even eating's hard enough, let alone actually looking and listening.
I've got this real sense of the students have kind of like, well, you know, you should play to any audience. You should be grateful to any audience. Like, no, I really don't care.
Well, no, that's not true. I mean, someone said to me when I started off on the gay circuit, actually, because I won a competition in a gay club in Tottenham Hale. And I did loads of gigs on the gay circuit. It was loads of fun. And some of them were really hard. I remember I died at a lot of them as well. And I remember someone saying to me, you should be able to play any audience, you know. And it was just that I was very inexperienced and I didn't understand really how to be myself on stage. Like you were saying earlier, Richard, you know, I think when you start off, you just completely kind of... I used to do these songs and then in between them I'd be like, thanks. And then I'd just do another one, look at the floor. And obviously, you know, it was quite boring to watch, quite annoying. And then this guy said to me, you know, well, you know, you should be able to entertain any crowd. But I don't think that's true.
Actually something we talked about with Rufus and the... though this is probably going to go out the wrong order, so it's something we will talk about with Rufus, which is
hey, we should talk about this with Rufus.
Yeah, we should. Let's do. I'll tell you what, if he comes in, let's talk about it with him. But that thing, which is you, it depends how you define yourself. If I go and see Richard Herring, because his show is called Richard Herring Entertainer, and I'm not entertainer. Though there is one of my favourites was Chris Addison once did a show called Gentleman Scholar Acrobat, as in the Rinky Dink Panther, and he did get an audience entirely of Spanish acrobat fans who would really presume that he was, because the other two he pretty much is, but acrobat wise he's rubbish. Danielle, we've been talking about the negative sides, but it is an incredible thing where for 1 month there are all these people together and you can see very, very exciting, bizarre things. So what have been the highlights of doing Edinburgh for you in the times you've done it?
Well, I've really loved doing my big, stupid musicals and plays. But obviously the problem with doing them is that they're the things that the press and industry aren't interested in. The thing that I find a bit sad about Edinburgh, I will get onto a positive thing in a minute, is that the reason it's not what it is you can't actually, if you want to do something genuinely experimental and exciting, it's not the place to do it anymore.
Oh,
I don't think it is. True. I don't think it is.
I've seen so many brilliant things that have been really successful.
Where do you do it, though? That's interesting, because I would say that there is a schism between what might be called the mainstream fringe and the kind of alternative fringe, that if you go over the bridge towards kind of more things like The Stand and also go to some of the free fringe events, people there feel that you can experiment more. And equally, there are still people, I think, doing this. But you're right, to some extent, you know, some... But then people like Will Hodgson have come out from Edinburgh. They've grown there. And Will Hodgson is certainly a very left-field act.
Things will always get
unfairly
lost. Yeah, he
is, and he's on Mock the Week all the time, isn't he?
No, but I'm not talking about what you then get as a result. What I'm talking about, you're saying, can you do something that, you know, you go, I'm going to push it a little bit.
Not like at Arthur the expense, though. I lost, when I did Sister Psycho, I lost £16,000. I could have put that on in London and not lost that much money.
You're doing a musical, it's your own stupid
fault. Exactly,
how are you going to do it? Right, it costs about 90 grand just to be a single performer going up there. If you're going to have a whole meet and you've got to buy the nun costumes, the instruments
Radio
the nuns
mic.
Play, the I knives think, the nuns
you
use.
You have to see it as an end in itself, that's the thing. I think going to Edinburgh, you have to think, what I'm doing is I'm going to Edinburgh and I want to do a show that works in Edinburgh and that's good in Edinburgh, and the show's good. It doesn't matter if people come, it doesn't matter what the reviews are, if I think it's good. I did, you know, I mainly throughout the 90s did plays and things like that, and I think they were all good and nothing ever happened with any of them, but it made me much better as a writer. I think as a result I ended up getting writing work out of it, you know, so it does sort of pay off. But I think the thing is people still have the mentality, even at the back of their minds, they're going, I'm going to go to this show and then I'm going to be discovered and it's going to be amazing or it's going to be big news. Actually, I think what you've got to do and what is better is to go up for 25 years and just get better at what you're doing, you know. And then eventually someone will go, hey, that was good. I did a show 20 years ago called Rara Rasputin, which I thought was really good.
I've seen some promotional material for that in the archive.
Which was, you know, the music of Boney M, as if Rasputin had created it all, and his life story told like that, like these musicals they do now, where they take the music of a band and put a story around it. And the BBC have just commissioned me to do it as a sitcom 20 years later.
It's a waiting game,
as a pilot episode.
That's what it is.
So
it's
like,
a waiting
if that
game.
Works like that, then all the ideas I've had in the last 20 years, I can now just live off for the next 20 years.
But you've got to get fat again to do Richard Herring is fat. You've got to put on loads.
I'm not saying it's about being discovered, though, but it's a very, very expensive vanity project.
It is, but then if anything, the but if you write something great, and you know, the thing is, your musical's been fantastic, Assist Psycho was amazing, and Take a Break Tales. You only need one person to, and the other one that would last
as well.
You know, you just need one person to see that, even if it's someone who then 10 years later goes, oh, I loved that thing, you know, and then you'll get... If you get a if you get a writing job out, if you write a TV script, you'll make that money back in, in 2 months of writing the script.
And sometimes the effect is cumulative.
Yeah.
Yeah, my most disastrous show, the one which ended me with punching the melon with Vernon Kay's face on and singing Mustang Sally, which was very, very difficult month.
Brilliant.
People who got it, it just turned out the few people who did get it all then employed me to do various interesting and different things. Yeah. It's just that everyone else in the audience had to put up with not understanding why a man was punching a melon and explaining why Vernon Kay and various other TV celebrities had ruined his career by distracting him writing links.
We did a show called The Dumb Show, which was me and Stu and Steve Coogan and Patrick Marber and Simon Munnery doing a sketch show together, which should have been, I mean, it was actually quite good and it should have been brilliant, but we all kind of infighting, but no one came and saw it. And Patrick Marber kind of gave up on it. And then the last week, Granada producer came to see it and was going, oh, I'd really like to put this on as a TV show. And Patrick Marber suddenly went, oh, right, we've all got to get to work together. But, you know, that would have been, it didn't come off, but it very nearly came off that this, you know, this sketch show that no one saw, no one liked, was seen by one person the last week, and suddenly it would have taken off. And that's kind of how Edinburgh is. It's just unfair and weird. And, you know, I felt I was overlooked throughout the whole of the 90s. I was doing, everyone was doing stand-up shows and I was doing theme shows and writing plays that I thought were really good and I still think were really good, but nothing ever came of any of
them. I guess maybe that's what I'm saying is, as a writer, I don't think Edinburgh's the right place to be doing stuff.
But it makes you do it, though, doesn't it? I would never have written any of those plays if it hadn't been for the deadline of Edinburgh, and that's what I still think. You know, you make a decision in March. It's like, you know, you decide to do something in advance that you haven't written. If it's just like someone said, oh, you could put on a show in London, but whatever, you know, when it's ready, we'll put it on. With Edinburgh, you can think, right, I'm going to do this show. You've decided in February, and then by April, you might think, oh God, I wish I hadn't said I'd do that. But you've got to, because then you think, oh crap, fuck, you know, people are going to be sitting in the audience. And all my plays, I mean, I was writing right up to the last minute, and even as we were there, you know, I mean, some of my shows in the 90s, I remember sitting in the Pleasance Courtyard trying to write the end of the show.
You were like that Bjork video, you were actually writing it and saying it at the same time.
It almost was. So, you know, they were very, I mean, you could do that then. And, you know, in the early days of Edinburgh, we lost like £2,000 a year. With the plays, I lost £10,000 a year, even in the late 90s. Because you just, you know, I didn't pay the actors really, generally, but you've just got to put five people up and, you know, and
rehearsal
all the stuff.
Costs
and
it's
all, you know,
like
you've got to rehearse for a month and it's kind of an expensive business. But I would say, ultimately, I don't think I'd have written Time, Gentlemen, Please if I hadn't written those plays. Someone like Frank Skinner keeps going, when are you going to write another play? He used to love my plays, you know, so it's just like, you just need one person like that. Yeah. He kind of keeps offering to bankroll me to write a play, you know. So you just need one person to see it and like it.
I think
it,
that's because he must have that money in that offshore scheme. Which put your money into doomed artistic ideas.
It could be, but that's
the nice thing about Edinburgh, is that you do have this back catalogue. Whereas if you're a circuit comic making your money in Jonglers, it's very easy to never have more than 40 minutes of material. Whereas, you know, Take a Break Tales is in the British Library as a piece of modern theatre.
There you go.
I think that's the thing, is you're right, you've got a deadline. That's why I talked about that with Sarah Kendall. Why do we go through this agony for a month sometimes? When, oh yeah, because it makes... last year I had to write four shows in the space of about 3 months. This year, I haven't done nothing.
No.
I've just written down, do something about the brain. That's it, because I'm not really doing Edinburgh. Danielle, Izzy, I want to actually make sure we do have some positive things. So I do think Edinburgh Fringe Festival, though it can be difficult, and though it can be, you know... I mean, the thing is, it's costly for... audience and acts as well. Someone makes a lot of money, but we won't go into that. There are some secret people who make a fortune while the acts and the audience are both ripped off, but not on the Free Fringe and various other
things. That's a good model for, you know.
It's a good model for a world financial system collapsing.
And you get free gin and tonic.
Wow. Which festival's that?
All my tickets are under £10 and you get a free gin and tonic.
That, finally, a plug after all that negativity.
That's a great
go
idea.
And see Danielle Ward's latest doomed artistic endeavour. Or are you merely doing this? No, I've heard this year she's just totally gone commercial.
Yeah, it's
no
really
nuns.
Commercial.
So this is... Izzy, what have you seen there? Or first of all, personal experiences that have been kind of going, this could only happen here. Because I do think, again, though we've been negative, no, not that. Josie just said a thing, and I think it was a personal experience. That
we've lived together
for
years.
Yeah, we've lived together. Yeah.
Right, if it's about any of the people that she used to have posters on her wall of and then later on got off with, we're not
I've
doing those stories,
I've got off with nobody.
Izzy. Not you, I'm talking about Izzy.
Izzy living in a box.
Did you ever have pillow fights together? That's what, in your pyjamas, that's what we wanted.
Listen,
right.
I do. I want to talk about my early experiences of Edinburgh. My dad was Scottish and he was from Edinburgh, so I used to go there a lot when I was a kid and I saw loads of shows there. And when I was a student, when I was in the summer of my first year, I just got, my parents had dropped me off in Edinburgh and had nowhere to sleep. I was actually thinking about committing. I was thinking, what crime can I commit that would put me in a cell for one night but not get me in any further trouble, because I didn't have any money for a hotel. And we it was so much fun. I went to Leighton Live when it was in the old venue, the one that burnt down, and I saw Johnny Vegas, and that was one of the most enjoyable and most sort of moving experiences of my life. Just seeing Johnny Vegas live for the first time and being in that room, it was so sweaty and kind of, you felt really anything could happen.
It's so intense as well. Yeah. Like properly.
Yeah.
I remember seeing, mine was seeing Raw Sex and Helen Ledra, Raw Sex, which I loved, which was Roland Riveron and very sadly the late Simon Brint. And that, when I, Raw Sex were my favourite thing. It was just Roland Riveron as this drunk guy. For those of you who don't know, too young to see it, they were on French and Saunders. They still kind of, until very recently, until Simon Brint died, would do bits in the Idiot Bastard Band, which is also Phil Jupitus and Neil Innes. And I just remember going, wow, this is amazing. And then I saw a play with Arthur Smithnick, I think called My Columbian Cousin, and going around and getting flyers, when flyers were exciting.
Yeah.
You know, even now people who are visiting in the Fringe go, this nuisance in my hand. Go, wow, what's this? A new John Godber play? I'm so excited.
Yeah.
Stephen Berkoff. They do Berkoff on the Fringe. I can't believe it.
I went to see loads of Berkoff and Ionesco when I was at drama school. It was just all on my own.
I saw, what's his name? Count Arthur Strong for the first time. That was the first thing that I'd laughed at so much. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't believe what he was doing. And it just every bit he did was like...
yeah.
When I was like 17.
The thing to remember is that sometimes when you go into a room, there's only like three or four of you there. You know, if we sell badly, we think, oh God, they're probably all sitting there thinking, what am I doing here? You know, actually, when I used to go into a room and there was three or four of us there, I often used to feel really excited, like this was a secret.
You felt good, yeah, yeah.
You know, what's going to happen? There's only four of us here. You know, is it still going to go ahead? And I genuinely used to feel... I went to see this Slovenian dance piece about goats and all these goats shouting. And there's like three of us there. And, I remember it forever. It's worth remembering that. I went to see Michael Smiley as well in the Courtyard. I must have only been about 16, I think, with my friend Hannah. And there was like two or three of us in the audience. And I'll remember that forever as well, because he just still did the whole show brilliantly, as if it was full. You know, it's so easy.
I once saw
it,
a flamenco dancer in, it was in London and near Tottenham Court Road, in a big room. We went there to have drinks, and there was like five people in the bar, and it's a flamenco dancer on, and she just did this flamenco dance like the room was full, like just did this amazing. And I think only I was watching it, and it was amazing. I don't even like dance, and it was amazing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you just sort of think that's what you've got to do when there's no one there. You've just got to perform it as if it's a full room, or just do your, you know, just actually increase your confidence and do a brilliant performance.
Did she have a pillow fight? Is that why you liked
it?
Did she have a pillow fight?
She didn't, no. That would have improved it if she had at the end.
That was my favourite thing. I remember doing The Usual Suspects, which was an old BBC Scotland radio cabaret show in 1997. And it ended with a flamenco dancer. Which is fantastic. So all you heard on the radio were just the fantastic rhythm of the heel.
Yeah,
nothing.
Yeah.
And it was... Even I decided I'd stop looking and imagine what it was going to be like on the radio.
But I think that, you know, Edinburgh is this emotional journey. It really is one of those roller coasters. And that's what's amazing about it, that you have those lows. And I remember being very, I'd had an argument with someone. And, you know, the problem is, like, you go, when you've been there so many years, there's so many corners of the town that have an unpleasant memory, or, you know, that actually become kind of bittersweet as you get a bit older and further away from them. But that's the place where I fell in love with her, and that's the place where we broke up, and that's where this happened. Yeah. So, you know, I remember being very depressed and then going to see Arthur Smith's, the one he did in the Botanical Gardens. Mm. And it was just the most life-affirming, wonderful thing. And I went to see it feeling so unhappy and left feeling so happy. And it's just that kind of craziness of Edinburgh that within an hour, your whole mood and the way you look at the world can completely turn around. But that's what it is, you know, it's just this emotional thing. You're worrying so much about your own stuff, and then sometimes you get too internalised, and then you can see something else and you know.
Well, that's the thing, actually, as well, is try not just to go and see, for anyone who's listening who's like a stand-up fan, go and see, I mean, have you ever seen Ridiculousness?
No.
Ridiculousness. There's a reason a lot of people don't go. I'd like to book tickets for Ridiculous. What else is on? But they're amazing. There's two guys who are, there are two now, this great kind of physical theatre where they just did a whole show, which was just, they were two men just talking to microphones. And then suddenly halfway through, they leapt up and down like chickens around the whole room for a while, and then just went back to the microphones.
I mean, there's a brilliant bit about the brilliant puppetry, Blind Summit, brilliant puppet company, do really funny, engaging puppet shows. And I just love
Gorka
it.
Gogo?
I also think, oh, Gorka Gogo, fantastic.
That's
where
I first saw Gorka. In fact, that's why I started the book club, was because I saw loads of things in Edinburgh where I went, wow, there's loads of great things. Gorka Gogo, who you must see.
You can always, what I think is, whenever you feel really worn out with stand-up, or whenever you feel like, oh, I always find new young people or new weird people or people that I thought I'd put in one box doing something so different and so new that it's like a wellspring. It's always like coming. And I also think that, like, now you've spent more than 2 years of your life living in Edinburgh, you know, and I've nearly spent a year of my life living somewhere else. And it's such a weird thing because, yeah, you accrue it over years. So it's like that David Nichols book, you know.
Yeah.
I haven't read it, but, you know. You have this secret other life that builds in. It's like Tom's Midnight Garden is what it's like, because you go there for a little bit, you go away, and then you come back.
Or like Narnia.
Yeah, exactly. And then but you're like, why are you so old, Mr. Thomas? I just blinked. Yeah.
Or David Eagleman's Son. David Eagleman's Son has that story where everything, I don't know if you, have you read David Eagleman's Son?
No.
Fantastic collection of short stories. And it's various different images of heaven. And one of them is, or the afterlife, whatever you want to call
it. Oh, yes, I do know that. I have
that. And it's got this great, where everything is actually, in one of the versions, everything happens just in a block. So you go into the loo, that happens in a block. That's just in one block. The 2 years you go into the loo, and your sleeping is in one big block, and you're eating. And of course, what ruins it is there's no joy, no excitement, because there's nothing unexpected. But then I was just thinking, imagine that block of Edinburgh. In that David Eagleman summer story, that would be.
So, what did you?
So, again, in terms of things that you've seen which have excited you, Danielle, or
I like going to see theatre. When I'm up in Edinburgh, I do go and see it a lot. I saw, and it wasn't the best thing I've ever seen, but it was really interesting. Was Get Carter? But,
really?
Yeah, in the Pleasance. It was a really weird production, but I enjoyed it a great deal.
Was that one that they actually took it from the book? It's Jack's Back, isn't it? The book is the Jack's Back, the book, I think. Yeah, and they.
Yeah, and it was on this weird slope. Because I, you know, having written weird plays and things, I'm always interested in the actual theatre of something. So, you know, how they do the lighting and how they make the moves on stage and stuff. So, I'm into see stuff like that. I'm really bad in Edinburgh. I don't go see anywhere near as much stuff as I should.
But I think
I get locked into a kind of, oh God.
And then you go, well, I can't see that before because it's before my show and I'll be tired. I can't see it after because
I make a thing of only, if I'm going to go and see a solo performer, I generally only ever go and see women as well. I think they do a lot more exciting stuff in Edinburgh because you get so many white male comics that just do.
Herring.
Sexist.
No, but you get the white male comics doing something that can be broken down and put on Michael McIntyre's roadshow. And I have no interest in that. Whereas the women I've been to see, like, even if it's not the funniest thing in the world, because it's not made
don't
like
a fucking show that.
No, I don't mean like as a female comic. I've seen female
sort of character
solo
comics,
not even characters or solo plays and things like that. So it's not necessarily just going to see comedy performed by women, which is obviously very funny.
There's a play about Margaret Rutherford this year, which excites me. I have very little time.
Oh, that reminds me. I tell you, a thing that I thought was really good was I went to the Hindley and Brady play. That was really good. It was really, really good, actually. That was in the Pleasance as well.
So this, I mean, the other thing, I just have to mention someone who I don't think is doing Edinburgh again this year, unfortunately, but for me, very much embodied with a great thing about the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which is Ben Moore, who, of course, we mentioned really.
Yeah.
Now, Ben Moore would go up every year, predominantly with one-person plays, sometimes other people in, and you would go, here is a man who has created this beautiful, wonderful piece with sometimes magical realism, idea, you know, super
the
collider for all the, for
is
all the
so
family.
Incredible.
And he used it, and he would also, he would go and see, he loved it.
Yeah.
And he would go and see everyone else's shows, never go in for free. He'd always felt that we were all in it together. That's, by the way, something you could, if TV people are listening, radio people, even when they can't claim the tickets back, always pay for tickets.
Yeah,
TV people who claim back every single meal they have and every single hotel still expect stuff for free because they're from the telly. Start using your expenses to pay performers, greedy television people. So
tell you what as well, Ben Moore, then you've got like Little Bulb and Hoi Polloi are two theatre companies that have done things that have been so engrossing and encapsulating.
Hoi Polloi are brilliant.
Oh, yeah, like Hugh Hughes.
Well, maybe that's the danger. Maybe that's what we're at the beginning of the podcast. We're talking about the way that it becomes this very kind of incestuous and claustrophobic world of stand-up. That one of the things to do is to actually make sure that you break out from. It's like I don't like hanging around the bars. Where last year I stayed in a wonderful place, drank in a wonderful place, the Royal Order of Antediluvian Buffaloes, the RAOB Club ROAB Club, and which I was doing a gig in as well. A room that was lined with tinfoil just because it wasn't hot enough. Anyway, and it was just great. It was basically a kind of, you know, just a drinking club below a hostel where the jukebox had such bizarre things, an enormous number of Scottish anthem. And you do a competition, everyone had to put a pound in, you got 7 plays for a pound, and you weren't allowed to double up on any play. So if you were there for 4 hours, eventually you would have to go, well, I don't know this particular theme of Loch Monagh, but I'll have to put that one on. And I think, yeah, finding those different places where people aren't... I mean, I was going to ask your favourite kind of social thing that's happened. Because there are some one of my to start off, my favourite was 20 years ago, a friend of mine did a version of Look Back in Anger, and he knew Daniel Farson, who well-known kind of part of the Soho scene in the 1950s and biographer Francis Bacon, and he was also quite a drinker. And one night he was just in this pub, and he used to have that proper that way of talking that, again, the Fast Show eventually did, which is, and he did this for half an hour. And he was talking about photography, supposedly. And then we got to the end, and he went, oh, so you like those photographers? What do you think about Robert Mapplethorpe? They went, I've been talking about him for half an hour. So those kind of people who are quite, you know, you will every now and then. It's like Stuart Lee, of course, found a pub that was so brilliant, he wouldn't tell any other performers because it would be ruined. And thus it closed, and he had nowhere to go the next year.
There's a good pub that I know about. I'll tell you guys.
Don't
after.
Tell the secret. But okay, so yeah, I would like you now, just so we end on a kind of a happy note, because as we said, it is an amazing time where this enormous amount of art occurs, and there is sadness and happiness. I think if you stop looking, going, what am I going to gain out of it? As you said, Rich, yeah. Just go. Oh, I hope I have fun doing my show. Mm. So, what was Josie?
My favourite things are, I go swimming in the sea every year, and I take loads of strangers, and we all have like a real ordeal of like, ah! And then afterwards we feel like a gang. And I used to run a boggle tournament that was really fun. We
get, oh yeah, the boggle tournament
that
was very successful, wasn't it?
I might revive that, not this year though, too tired. Yeah. And I also loved Mark Watson doing 24-hour shows. Those were like, anything where there's like a show possibly, but it's really like a comedian's fun gang competition. I really love anything that's sort of a bit silly and a bit...
Like Karaoke Circus.
Fun. Yes, Karaoke Circus, in fact, yeah, is one of my absolute Edinburgh
highlights. Are you doing
highlights.
It again?
I love it.
No, we're not.
Why
it
not?
Used to be my highlight until the arrogant comedy management company Avalon came in for free
that
around the back
brilliant.
Way and then talked really loudly.
Oh, of course, it no. was during your song.
Yeah, and then
song,
were chucked out
it?
Anyway,
that's
and got into a lot of trouble.
Out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was amazing.
Yeah, my beautiful version of Rolf Harris's Two Little Boys.
Karaoke Circus.
I should
one
say
of
the arrogant
joyful.
Comedy management company Avalon look after Richard Herring.
They do,
which is why he's the only one in here in a suit and right. shoes that are glued.
So he threw money at me earlier.
Yeah,
those money.
Probably an Arthur Circus, ACMS, Alternative Comedy Memorial Society, which is quite a new kind of venture that's run by John Luke Roberts and Tom Tuck last year in the Pleasance. Karaoke Circus, I was very drunk when I did it and like threw myself on the floor.
Most people are very... It's like Tim Vine, when he did Elvis Presley, he got a vinyl version of the 68 Comeback Special leather suit, yeah, which was... he couldn't put it on until he had to go on stage because the amount of sweat by the end of it was fantastic.
Yeah, so good. Brilliant. Tim Vine is so good at karaoke. Yeah.
He is, like, isn't he?
His gib... really goes for it. What are they called? Bee Gees.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible.
He's good at that. Jokes and getting a pencil behind his ear.
Yeah,
that's or pen behind his ear, rather. Yeah, I should say pen behind his ear. I'm looking at a pencil. Danielle, what about you?
I don't want to blow my own trumpet. I've always really enjoyed doing Karaoke Circus for the simple fact that being on stage and not having to control a crowd is really nice. Like just knowing that I can do anything because I'm not having to speak. It's all just with an instrument. I've always loved doing that. And also when I've like done the stupid musicals. Because when you're a stand-up, you're obviously by yourself before you go on stage. And when you've got a cast around you, it's actually really lovely. And then you'll go out for a drink afterwards. That's what I'm going to miss this year. Because I'm doing a stand-up show and a play, but no one else is in the play. So
yeah, you're doing different... You're alternating. Hard. So you're doing a stand-up show one day and a play the other day. So Daniel Ward be excellent. Richard Herring?
I think I enjoy sitting in bars and talking to the old farts. I really enjoyed talking to Barry Cryer. In one afternoon, I think.
With an odd link, of course, you said the old farts.
Yeah,
Willie Rushton was two
was
old farts the night, the show they did.
So, you know, it's just nice to kind of... I like that kind of... I like the fact that you can... Barry Cryer's there and then you'll be chatting with some 19-year-old new comedian and you kind of think, wow, that sort of spans 60 years and if that kid lives and still performing when he's 70, you know, there's this kind of link. I love all that. The history of... I mean, it's sort of weird thinking this year, when I first went up in 1987, if you took 25 years off of that, that'd be 1962. So me, the for a new person going up now, I'm the equivalent of someone for me who went up in 1962 for the first time. So Michael Palin, not in terms of profile, yeah, but in terms of that kind of time. I think he was probably a little bit earlier, but that kind of group of people. So it's kind of, that history is incredible when you sort of think it like that and flip it around. So if someone was, you know, if there was a 45-year-old man performing at Fringe, which there obviously was in 1987, you know, that would be the same. So I love that kind of, that kind of passing the torch down. The fact that when we did the Oxford Theatre Group stuff in the early days, that's where the Oxford Theatre Group had, we'd stayed in a Masonic lodge, and that's where the Oxford Theatre Group had always been for years and years. And there was stories passed down the generations. There was a story about Esther Ranson behind the little counter there was in this place. I won't say what the story was because it's rude, but it might not be true. But it's kind of amazing that that's got, you know, that got passed down the years, because it's that little, it's what life is, isn't it? It's this little
life is Esther Ranson behind a counter doing something which can't be.
That's life.
Brilliant work, Josie.
Thank you.
I also wanted to just mention in turn the audience, because I do think that you do get some very excitable, and in a good way. Like I was thinking last year when I was doing four shows a day, I lost my voice really quickly, and the moment you just kind of tweet and go, really sorry, but the shows are going to sound weird, and that night loads of people, they bought tunes, lockets, anything they could find, and people will, this is part of the Free Fringe, which I think the Free Fringe, PBH's Free Fringe, has a very, and probably all the Free Fringe, I don't know the other side of it, but I think that thing where you can have a relationship with like people go, I've made you some muffins, so I thought you'd be hungry because you're doing so many shows, or did a lunchtime science show once, and this lady just came up to you, she went, that was wonderful, and she just put £5 in the bucket and said, can I give you a hug? I've had so, you know, those kind of things.
I really
so
wish I was doing the Free Fringe.
Favourite audience things then?
Some people made me some biscotti and they were gluten free. That was pretty kind. I get a lot of things made for me, actually. I really, really do get people.
I think that's
very
the thing
kind.
Is, I think that perhaps that's the reason we do these podcasts is that we are the kind of people that people think, well, I can't imagine they make a living out of this. We better bring them food and gifts.
Please help me. I'm all alone in the world. I've got some good things. I'll tell you what happened to me once in the Melbourne Fringe Festival is that this guy, I was doing this thing where I was giving out postcards.
It's not about the Melbourne Fringe Festival. Though.
Well, it's a bit similar.
Okay, so no one has ever been kind to you at Edinburgh. Is that what you're saying? That your audience there is cruel. Okay, you can do the Melbourne story.
Forget it.
No, do it.
Well, this guy came and he brought me this massive box, and in it was all these sort of goodies and also all these free address postcards to his friends and relatives. And he was like, if you want, we're sending you postcards, you can send them postcards.
That's cool. Nice.
Yeah, it was wicked. I've had loads of stuff like that.
Have you had... audience,
a really kind Scottish man once gave me £20 to leave the stage.
I don't think I'm very approachable. I don't get given anything.
No, nor do I.
No, but you must have had reactions where you've done a show and there's something where, again, because all of that wall's kind of broken down, that you're standing in a bar and there's lots of people there and you can have that interaction.
There was once when me and Roisin, the very last night of our run, we had sold one ticket and it was to a woman... with she had no hair, she had alopecia, and she was standing outside, she was pouring down in rain. She was this American woman, and I said, oh, we've only sold one ticket, you should go and see something else. You could have my pass, go and see anything else. And she went, oh, I've got to get a train at 9:30, so this is the only show I can now fit in. And we were going, you shouldn't miss it. And she went, no, please, please do the show for us. Please do the show for us. So she went and sat in the audience and I sobbed in the toilets because I think it was also because it was the end of the Fringe. But and she was really nice. We ended up having six people in and someone bought some pizza and everybody sat there eating pizza for the show. And it was one of the nicest experiences.
Did you use the microphones? It's always weird when there's that.
I think we did, yeah, but we had them set quite low. I'm no sound engineer, but I don't like it. You know, when they have a microphone really loud and you think, it's just for show. You might as well not bother.
Rich? There's lots of those things with the podcast. We did This Morning with Richard Not Judy that started off as an afternoon show where we just would chat with people and the audience had to bid for tickets and stuff, which was all very good. And we gave whoever gave the most money got treated like a king, which we then did on the TV show. But one time, the big issue seller, Murray, who has sadly subsequently died, not as a direct result of this story. He kind of saved up all his... because you were getting your money double back, I think, or something as well. So he realised he saved up all his money and then kind of did this thing and became king of the show and then just got, like, dangerously drunk. We had this kind of trolley of all this booze and stuff, and he just kind of realised if he kind of gave it his money, he'd get the money back and he would also be able to drink as much as he possibly could in an hour. But we became very good friends with him. It's a really sad story because he unfortunately did die of a heroin overdose eventually. But he, But he was. I remember him saying to me that the when we all turned up, he'd go, you know, this is the only bit of my year that's worth being alive for this year. When you're, because he was the big issue seller in the Pleasance Courtyard and the roundabout there. But it, you know, it was a really kind of connection with this guy we made, who then unfortunately then went in 1 year and he wasn't there, and took me a week or two to ask people where he was, and it turned out he died, unfortunately. So that's a bit of a sad downer at the end of that story.
Well, it's not, though, because it's a very nice, still very nice story. And yeah. So, yes, so if, for those of you who made it through the early negativity of the podcast, the Edinburgh Fringe Festival probably begins in about the beginning of August, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm only up there for 2 days. It's and where we will be doing a podcast with, I believe, Neil Gaiman and Amanda Palmer. There's our trailer for that.
So
thank you very much to Izzy, Danielle and Rich, and also thank you to me and Josie Long.
Thank you to us.
Yeah. Just so having thank a good you, time. Because we're going to both do it, aren't we?
It's very true.
You've been listening to Robin and Josie's Utter Shambles. The podcast was produced by Adrian McKinder and edited by Mike Pell. For more podcasts, go to comedycentral.co.uk/podcasts.